stay up and throw my voice about you. Or less about you and more about how I ruin everything I think could be good news. That's Julian Baker. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. The Blue Jays got some good news yesterday and then ruined it with a bunch of bad news. A flurry of transactions before a 13-8 loss to the Texas Rangers. Yes, Bo Bichette returned. Stuart Baroa was also up, but that was because Dalton Varsho out for the season with some tearing in his rotator cuff. He'll undergo surgery. His 2025 spring training status is at least a little in question until he gets under the knife and starts recovering and sees what that timeline is like. Will Wagner is also done for the year, dealing with knee inflammation. He is headed to Cleveland for a closer look at that, although that was a known issue from before the trade deadline, that he was dealing with there. So a lot to sort through with those two things. Nice to see Stuart Baroa back. Certainly nice to see Bo Bichette back. He seems happy. It was also a very eventful day around Major League Baseball that involved a former Toronto Blue Jay doing something he hadn't done since 2014, a certain all-star showing feet, and a bunch of chaos in the two wild card races. The Blue Jays also lost a game 13-8. Let's talk about all that. Oh, yeah, Nick Robertson was claimed off of waivers and optioned to AAA, because if you are a quad A reliever, you will be claimed and optioned by the Toronto Blue Jays when you get DFA'd right now. One other note. Adam Macko got called up to AAA yesterday. The AA season had ended. He got bumped to AAA. Pitched three innings, allowed three earned with three strikeouts, three walks, and four hits. Jonathan Clase also had a four-hit game in that one and stole base. And Aurelvis Martinez had a homer and three walks. So interesting things happening with the Buffalo Bisons. We will talk Vancouver Canadiens a little later in the show. Brent LaValle, the manager of that team that just made it to the Northwest League Finals, will join us a little later. John Morosi will join us. Chris Black will join us. And right now, joining us from deep in the heart of Texas, of MLB.com and BlueJays.com, it's Keegan Matheson. Keegan, I imagine the coolest and driest you will be today. How we doing?
I'm doing well, man. I'm a little too deep in the heart of Texas. And yesterday, I think back, Blake, to when I was publicly shamed last year for taking an Uber to the stadium. I can see out this window right here. And you know what? I'm secure in who I am as a man at this point. I'm Ubering to the ballpark today. I got there yesterday. I slung a hotel towel over the bag. I looked like an R&B singer at the end of a set when I got there. It was a bad scene, man. It's a different world down here. I thought I was done with this stuff. You know, I thought we were done with the heat. But Texas is, once again, of the many places in baseball, this is a place.
It is going to get up to 35 degrees there today, according to the weather that I just looked up in Arlington. They would call it 100, but we'll call it 35 because that's how the metric system works, or whatever we call our temperature system. All right, man. So sweat aside, it was also a very busy day for you yesterday. There was a flurry of injury news, both positive and negative, for the Toronto Blue Jays, in addition to a baseball game that was really long and furthers my belief that if both teams are a certain number of games below 500 past a certain part in the season, you should lose the right for within inning pitching changes. You should just have to finish out the inning no matter what.
You need to earn the privilege of challenging a play. And that was bad baseball. That's okay. Not all 162 are going to be great. It was not a great baseball game.
No, a couple errors. Chris Bassitt gets hung with seven runs, but only one of them earned. So, I don't know. You can't feel good about that one, but at least it doesn't hit the old ERA there. Headline item, Keegan, and we knew this coming in. Bo Bichette returns to this one. He gets two cheapies on kind of infield hits. Can't argue with that. What was the buzz around the team? What was the feeling around the team with Bo Bichette finally returning after, you know, basically half a season down here?
It was interesting to hear him talk pregame, and we've talked about this a lot over the years, Blake, that when Bo Bichette does speak, it's because he has something to say, and if he does not have something to say, he keeps it short and sweet, and that's totally fine. You know, that's his right to do. Yesterday, he kept coming back to the same point about how grateful he was to be playing baseball again, and how happy he was to be there, how this was his dream he's living out, but grateful, grateful, grateful. He kept saying the same thing over and over, and if he were a rookie coming up for his debut, I'd say, okay, sure, you're happy to be here. This is some nice fluff to fill the day. That was different than what I've heard from Bo Bichette in the past. That's not to say that he has not been grateful to be in the big leagues, of course. But it seems like this time away from the team, close to 2 months that he was on the IL working back, has been a really valuable opportunity for him to do some self-reflection, to look in the mirror, to think about what baseball means to him, what these opportunities mean to him. And I think he's a player who has always appreciated those very well and handled that side of the game well. But something seemed different yesterday talking to him. And then, of course, the interesting note at the end there that he's also working with his father, Dante Bichette, a bit more. He said that, you know, we all get to the point where we want to know better than our parents, and he think he got there. But now he seems to be working with Dante a bit more again, which was always a bit more approach over physical mechanics. But it was interesting that that was dropped in at the end. And again, I don't think by accident.
Yeah, it's always a fascinating one with Dante Bichette in general, who was like officially a part of the staff a couple years ago. The Blue Jays have always given leeway for guys to bring in family members like that. Vlad has obviously worked with family members in the past. Dalton Varsho has had his father, former major league outfielder, in the past working with him and Don Mattingly and things like that. The Jays have given guys leeway to do, you know, what works for them individually in addition to the resources they provide. Dante, of course, in addition to people's desire to draw a line from the team hit a lot of home runs when he was around to they didn't hit a lot of home runs when he wasn't around, there were a couple of personnel changes that might have, like Marcus Semien might have been 48 home runs out the door, Teoscar Hernandez out the door, Lourdes Gurriel Jr. out the door. I don't know that we chalk it all up to Dante Bichette, but that relationship and the potential for too many voices or conflicting voices has been a little controversial at times in the past, or at least a little touchy. So what did you make of that aspect of it, especially because, as you said, Bo Bichette doesn't drop that in there without intention?
Yeah, this is something that's more and more of a conversation, I think, every year in baseball. The Blue Jays themselves have 10 hitting coaches. Most organizations are going in that way, where there's not just a hitting coach. It used to be just an old grizzled batting coach who told you what to do, who looked at film, and that was it. There was one voice. There's a sweet spot that's probably between that and where we are now. In Major League Baseball, it's one of those things that's really gone a long way. But this is unique to, not unique to baseball. In hockey, a lot of guys have skating coaches they work with. In football, you see a lot of guys work with a quarterback coach in the offseason. It's not unique to baseball, but baseball is the sport that already has so many voices growing internally. So if a player is going to do that, A, it needs to work, and B, it needs to be a player that you can trust to manage all of that information and to respect all of the voices. That's a big part of this. And I think Bo is that player, certainly. I think he is a guy that can do that. It's a conversation, like you said, Blake, we've had with Vladdy a lot over the years, especially when he was struggling. You'd look one day and his uncle would be on the field. And there were times I saw that and I would think, oh man, like it's getting a little crowded in the kitchen. And now with Bo, if this works, if he is comfortable, and as long as all of the other voices are being respected, which I think they are, I have no reason to believe they're not, I think that's okay. But it's something that's becoming bigger and bigger in baseball, and you, at the very least, you want the voices to align a bit. And that's going to be something interesting to see how teams work with what I'll broadly call more independent voices in these situations. Because if you have the team telling you, let's hit for contact, and your offseason hitting coach telling you, shut up, you can hit 40 home runs, that's a problem. I don't think that's the case here, but you see that with a lot of young prospects coming up. And a lot of young pitching prospects coming up. It is quietly a problem on a lot of fronts for a lot of individual cases. But I think Bo is all right, though. I think he knows his swing, and especially a swing that's so unique.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, Bo's a guy where we've talked about it even when he's slumping. Like, you can't give him the same advice that you'd give other hitters because he is a very different cat at the plate and approach-wise and things like that. Like, you don't want Bo Bichette to shrink his zone too much and never chase because him being dangerous, you know, low and away to poke one to right field is part of the package, although it was at least a little amusing first plate appearance back, the strikeout on the slider going low and away outside of the zone. And yeah, to your point, there is a lot of this. Like last year, the big story was Cole Ragans, right? Like he gets traded from Texas to Kansas City. They give him a reprieve. They're like, yeah, you want to go work with Driveline in season? Or I can't remember if it was Driveline or one of those places, but like, you need to do some work in season, whatever, go for it. And, you know, whether that's the Royals being laissez-faire in general, or it's part of a, hey, we don't know this player yet, let's empower him to do what he thinks works for him. But it's worked. Cole Ragans for Aroldis Chapman looks like a very, very good trade for Kansas City, even though Texas obviously got what they wanted out of it too. So it's not you know, it's not unique to Bo Bichette or the Toronto Blue Jays, but it is always interesting when there are a couple different voices going on there. Okay, so at on the field, what are we looking for from Bo these last 2 weeks other than staying healthy and more, you know, more meaningfully? This 2 weeks won't change any of what we're feeling, but how are we level setting on what we expect from Bo Bichette in 2025 after such an odd 2024?
Just a normal couple weeks. I'd love to see some power from him. That was certainly missing early on, really driving the baseball. But a normal, healthy couple of weeks. And to look like himself. Now, looking like yourself means different things to different players. For Vladdy, that means a 450-foot homer. For Bo, that means the classic hit we've seen 1,000 times, which is a line drive or hard ground ball that he shoots through the right side of the infield. That's when he is at his best. That's when he's comfortable. That's when he really knows the swing. So you want to see a couple of those old signs. Him making a couple of plays on the move defensively, which is typically when his athleticism shows. Something normal. And when we asked him about that last night, he said, you know what, results would be great, but I'm already ending on a high note. I'm back here. I'm happy, which is a great way to look at it. I wish I could do the same myself more often, but he's happy to be here. And I think that's a good enough start. Because Bo going into this offseason, we've talked about it a lot, Blake. I don't think anything in this organization has the power to change 2025 like Bo Bichette does. Because he can be a star. The Blue Jays do not need another 39-year-old DH. They need a star. And Bo Bichette can be that because he has been that. So getting him back to that is so important. And even just a normal 2 weeks where he hits 250, hits a home run, shoots some line drives around, that's enough of a start to send him back into next spring in a normal headspace where he's not trying to rebound or react from anything. It's just normal.
Yeah, which is, you know, I think that's a good way to put it. And yeah, the swing of Bo Bichette being back to Bo Bichette in 2025, where like obviously a lot of the talk the next couple of weeks will be, you know, okay, you don't really need to autopsy this team because we've known, like you watch it over 162 games, you know what's going wrong and things like that. But when you look at what could be better in 2025, other than go out and spend a bunch of money, which they also need to do, Bo Bichette being like, by Fangraphs metrics, 5 wins more valuable than he was this year would be a pretty big swing. Like there's no other player on the roster that can swing their performance quite to that degree. All right, so Bo Bichette's back. That's the positive. Because it's the 2024 Toronto Blue Jays, not only could we not get the Bo Bichette positive news yesterday without one negative, we couldn't get it without two negatives as Dalton Varsho and Will Wagner both announced as out for the season. Let's start with Dalton Varsho. He is going to undergo surgery, it sounds like, to repair a partial tear in his right rotator cuff, something that's been bothering him since August. My primary question, I don't know if you got a clean answer on this yesterday, Keegan, why was he playing through this in this, like with the season as it is and the point in the year that we're at here? Like, especially with the John Schneider dropping in that we'll see how he recovers, but he might not be ready for the start of spring in 2025. Why was he still playing?
Yeah, great question. I mean, especially when you're dealing with a shoulder injury and when you're talking about rotator cuff, like that's not small.
No.
This is something that we normally talk about, of course, more with pitchers. I'm much more familiar with this injury when we're talking about pitchers, not an outfielder. But it's significant. You know, we're not talking about a year or two significant, but it's not a small short-term injury because the shoulder is such a complex part of the body and the healing process there is complicated and it can take a while. And it's been interesting. Interesting is the word I'll land on, Blake, here. It's been interesting how this has come out and played out with him bouncing in and out of the lineup, dealing with that pain. And Dalton is a player I respect a ton because he's a very tough player and a very dedicated player. And I know he'd be a hard one to take out of that lineup. But at a certain point, if there's an issue like this going on, you want to get out ahead of it as far as you can, especially in a season that's been over for a long, long, long time. So this is a worrying one going into the offseason. And the Blue Jays, as it often has happened with a lot of the elbow injuries on the pitching front this year, this kind of came out slowly and slowly and slowly until boom. Oh, he's having surgery? That same process has played out a few different times this year. And with Varsho now, this could stretch into spring training, which John Schneider said yesterday. And if the Blue Jays are saying that right now, that that's an option, you have to prepare as if he's going to miss some time early in the season. I'm not saying that he will. This is a complicated recovery that could have a bit of a window. Maybe he's fine for opening day. But in baseball, you need to be pessimistic and prepare for a longer scenario. That impacts the Blue Jays' offseason plans because you need that elite defender in center field. You need Dalton Varsho to be able to come back and have a throwing arm. How's that going to be in March and April? That's a bit worrying. And how will that impact him at the plate? Especially, Blake, if even if he is coming back just around opening day, starting a rehab, if there's anything, and I don't learn much anymore these days. I'm kind of, you I know what I know. But if there's anything I've learned these past few spring trainings, covering spring each year, it's that if you are forced to play catch-up, you're toast. And this goes for pitchers and for hitters. If you get a month behind everyone else, it's so tough to catch up. And I would hate to see Varsho put in that situation, a guy who works like he does, but that's the risk the Blue Jays are looking at now. And this is suddenly, Blake, it even because it crept up so quickly yesterday, I even needed an hour to kind of sit down in the press box and think, wow, this is a really big story.
Yeah,
and it's going to be a big story all offseason.
Yeah, and you're right about the catching up is so difficult, right? And that's, it tends to be more prominent on the pitcher side because hitters can catch up a little more quickly when you get the reps in and things like that. But it was one of the stories of the early part of the season for the Blue Jays with Jordan Romano and Eric Swanson around baseball with Blake Snell and Jordan Montgomery having signed late. And then obviously Blake Snell has very much figured it out. But like a terrible start to the season for both of those guys who got late starts and had to do, the minor league ramp up outside of spring training. So this also introduces an interesting question in terms of roster composition, Keegan, where we all think Dalton Varsho is going to play center field for, if healthy, 140, 150 games next year. That is pretty locked in. It's one of the most locked in things on the roster. And we know that the Blue Jays are probably going to be shopping for some power, and left field tends to be a position where you can address some of that power. Does this change how you're looking at the roster at all in terms of like, hey, someone you go out and get to play a corner outfield, it would be nice if they could play a little bit of center field in a pinch? Does the presence of Joey Loperfido, Stuart Baroa, Nathan Lucas, Jonathan Class A, like you have a couple guys, four guys who could ostensibly be on the 40-man who could play center field? Like, is that enough coverage? What do you make of that side of this?
Yeah, I think who the Blue Jays want to be next year matters a lot. Yeah, Loperfido, we've seen the talent. You need to see it across the stretch. Nathan Lucas, the Blue Jays haven't given him many opportunities. How will he handle center in the big leagues? Jonathan Class A is incredibly talented. I'm excited to see him, but we've got to see him in the major leagues. And his start in AAA up until last night, that big game, hasn't been the best. Stuart Baroa, the Blue Jays haven't exactly fallen over themselves to play him. If the Blue Jays were projected as a 70-win team next year, who were kind of getting back on the rise, a year away from contending, absolutely. You're happy with all of that. See who can handle it, and you can have more of a competition into the season. But if the Blue Jays are trying to compete, and they obviously are next season, that would point me more in the direction, Blake, if, and again, I'll keep hammering the if, because this is a complicated recovery, if Varsho does need to miss any time into the season, that would point me more in the direction of the kind of veteran, elite defender, light hitter type of center fielder who covers you defensively for a few weeks or for a month. But I'm not sure if you're going to find that offensive upside at that point. And in that case, man, you've got to nail left field. You've really got to do something with left field or third base, something to add some power to this lineup. I mean, I don't know if Kevin Kiermaier would sign a 1-month contract or what that looks like, but I would be more pointed, hypothetically, in the direction of a glove first veteran outfielder who can help you off the top of the season and then be a very good backup and good defender through the rest of the year if needed.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you'd hope that you get a little more bat than this, but a Michael Taylor type is always out there, right? Yeah. I mean, he's had a remarkably bad season at the plate, but is still a plus defender in center field and a right-handed bat, which is probably, a tiebreaker the Jays would lean toward given how lefty heavy the composition of the roster is. So That's all interesting stuff, as well as, you know, has Dalton Varsho done enough to secure the Gold Glove, which, who knows, maybe that was part of why didn't shut down a couple weeks ago. We don't know. Will Wagner is a little more straightforward. Sounded like from yesterday, the reporting around that is the team knew he had something bother him in his knee even before the trade, wanted to get a look at him here. Hey, you looked great. Let's get a two-week start on the offseason. Go get that knee checked out in Cleveland. What did you make of the Will Wagner element yesterday?
Yeah, when we go back to the, you know, the Varsho news and pitching news, I guess I'm still hesitant to really exhale with things with the Toronto Blue Jays, but this one does not sound like anything major right now with Wagner at the Blue Jays, and he's in Cleveland getting those opinions right now. Ideally, this is just an inflammation, extreme wear and tear type of deal that the offseason can take care of. And Will Wagner, I mean, full credit to him, in his month and a half with the Blue Jays, has done more than I ever could have predicted he would do. I liked him as a player. I did not see something this good. And he's looked fantastic and really put himself into those 2025 plans. And a month or two ago, Blake, I would have said in 2025, I loved the idea of Aurelvis Martinez and Spencer Horwitz platooning at second base. Horwitz isn't a second baseman anymore. Maybe that's Wagner and his fit in there. I think second base can really be an exciting platoon spot for the Blue Jays. And Wagner, at the very least, has forced himself into that conversation. He is the exact type of hitter the Blue Jays love. If you like him, the Blue Jays love him, I promise. And he really seems to have fit this team. There haven't been any red flags, either defensively, base running wise. Everything seems very solid. And as long as this is just a end of the season, everybody's beat up type of injury, that shouldn't impact next year whatsoever. So he's done himself a ton of favors, and I really like what we've seen from him.
We're going to take a turn off of the injury stuff here, but it's still roster related. Maybe you were too busy with all this stuff yesterday. Did you get a chance to talk to Tyler Heineman at all and be like, you're back, man. What's going on here?
Not quite during the mess of all of that, but Heineman, when he walked out into the dugout, I was actually looking, we were joking, a couple of us, I was looking for Dalton Varsho to chat with him about his shoulder. Tyler Heineman and Dalton Varsho look eerily similar, which you don't know until you're looking for Dalton Varsho. But Heineman, man, next year, how's he going to get onto this roster next year? It's going to have to be like he goes to play in Japan and is purchased from a team over there. There's got to be a fourth way to do this.
The reverse Mr. Baseball, yeah.
Yeah, this is an interesting one, though, man. It sets him up as a potential depth option for next year. The Blue Jays, they're going to need to address their catching depth somehow. It needs to be with more of a 1A to Kirk's 1B or vice versa. But they have always loved Tyler Heineman, and no matter where he goes, he comes home. There's something the Blue Jays love about the guy. And I think, as most Blue Jays fans know, a great clubhouse guy who's very beloved by all those teammates. So it was, a nice jolt of energy, I guess, yesterday that we should have seen coming.
So, okay, I am going to circle back to Dalton Varsho, and I will ask, obviously yesterday is probably not something he felt the best about. How is he feeling about your Packers and Malik Willis helping them to a victory? Obviously, tougher one with Tennessee this weekend, but you and Varsho and the Shulmans all got to be feeling better than maybe you did this time last week.
We all believed in Malik Willis, all of us, because, I, like Dalton and the Shulmans, I mean, one of us out of that group is a little less level-headed than the rest. I'll let everyone guess it's me. And I was a bit of a Malik Willis worrier. I will not say hater, but a worrier going into last week. That was a Matt LaFleur masterclass, let me tell you. That was I'm at the point where I think he is one of the top five coaches in the NFL. And if you can make Malik Willis look that good, my goodness. So just load Josh Jacobs up with a good meal this week. Give him 40 carries again. Back is back. They never left, but they're back.
Man, post-op Dalton Varsho, how many trades is that guy sending in the Jays fantasy league? Like, he's already the most intense about it, the feeling that I got, and now you're going to have him up. I guess he'll only be using his left hand on the old Yahoo app there, but anyway, how have your first 2 weeks gone, by the way?
Man, I among many other people, have been bitten by the injury bug But I like to build narratives for myself. You know, this is, I am not down. I'm going to build this into the hero's return, you know, and I'm a big believer, Blake, that a little anxiety can work in your favor. And I anxiously drafted all of my handcuffs. So I've always got myself protected. I'm usually a little too safe with that. But now that everybody's knees and hips and shoulders are exploding, I'm happy with it, but I'm in survival mode right now.
Okay.
This is not my time to thrive. This is just my time to survive. When the temperature's cool, late October, early November, all my boys are healthy again. You'll see me rolling into spring training next year in a nice Rolls Royce off of all these wheels. It's going to be great.
Yeah. I can't imagine you're playing in leagues that, that heavy money, but, we'll see.
Bar tab leagues. Yeah.
And hey, we're a couple days away from WNBA playoffs. So you'll have a little extra, to do with your, we'll call it your entertainment budget at the end of these, baseball days. Keegan, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Stay cool down there in Texas.
You got it, buddy. We'll talk soon.
Keegan Mathison of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. A lot of great stuff up at BlueJays.com yesterday on the Bo Bichette return, the Varsho and Wagner injuries. Of course, a lot to sift through there. We'll continue to do it throughout this show as well. We'll also take a look outside of Toronto. There was a lot going on in Major League Baseball yesterday in the wild card races. Jose Altuve took his shoe and sock off to point to his toe and say, look, I got hit by a pitch, and he got tossed for that. Marcus Stroman picked up a save. He's gotten bumped to the bullpen. It's the first time he picked up a save since the final game of his 2014 rookie season. Yeah, good for him. That's a cool one to see. And then, of course, we didn't talk a ton about that game, but Bo had two hits in his return. Vlad had another three-hit game. Davis Schneider stayed red hot. We'll talk to Chris Black about that a little later. George Springer had a triple and also got picked off. 13 hits and 5 walks overall for the Jays. And of course, because it was a day that ended in Y, Leo Jimenez got hit by a pitch. He did not have to take his cleat and his sock off like Jose Altuve to argue it, because, yeah, he just gets hit by 9% of pitches or whatever it is. We'll talk about that with Chris Black as well. We'll also talk to Brent LaValle, manager of the Vancouver Canadiens team that just finished second in the Northwest League, the Blue Jays High A affiliate. After the break, though, we'll go down to Milwaukee. We'll talk to John Morosi of MLB Network. He's down there for the Phillies Brewers series, one that is pretty meaningful for getting the bye in the National League. Also, two teams that are, of course, going to be very, very playoff relevant 2 weeks from now. John Morosi next as Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet 360.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. We are only on the Sportsnet 360 and Sportsnet Plus side, as well as the All Feed online. If you were looking for Toronto Maple Leafs Media Day, that is over on Fan 590 proper. JD Bunkus leading our coverage of that. It also means I don't get to play songs coming back from commercial, which is sad. But it's for a good reason. It's NHL Media Day. It's the start of the NHL season proper. It's fun. It's good. I'm sure John Morosi of MLB Network and NHL Network is fired up. He joins us now. John, good morning. How are we doing?
Doing great, Blake. I'm just wondering, does the parade run along Bloor or Young when the Leafs win the Cup? I'm just trying to figure that one out.
I imagine by the time that happens, all of the streets will have different names. The city will look entirely different. The skyline won't be recognizable. That is a problem for the person in this chair 30, 40 years from now, John.
No. There will not be flying cars, Blake. Will not be flying cars when the Leafs win the Cup. Hey, we've got Captain America running the show now, number 34. I think it's going to be a good year for the Leafs.
We'll talk mostly baseball, but you're a big NHL guy as well. What are you most excited about this season? What do you look for kind of this time of year where everyone's just, you know, everyone's healthy, everyone's vibes are good, everyone has zero losses on the record? What are you looking for as an NHL fan?
Well, a couple things. I'll say this. I mean, coming off of a great Cup final, and that was just great hockey. And I think that you obviously saw McDavid win the Conn Smythe deservedly, even as his team did not win the Cup. And that amazing clip that was released, obviously, in the last couple months of the Oilers in the dressing room as McDavid's name was being announced and he was still with his guys. I think that tells you a lot about his character, and he was not going to go out there and accept an individual award in the middle of all that. And I just think that reflects so well on who he is and what he represents to the sport. So I think that leaving that off at the end of the spring is an important jumping off point for what we've got right now. And I think too, when you've got a best on best tournament coming up, which, I mean, I love best on best hockey. You love best on best hockey. We all do. That to look forward to in February is epic. We're going to have, I think, a continual roster discussion every time someone scores a hat trick, or every time a Canadian goaltender has a couple of shutouts in a row, hey, he's going to be the guy. And so I love whenever you've got a year in which you've got a best-on-best tournament coming up, there's always that the standings are there, but there's that continual idea of who's going to represent the countries, which I think just adds another layer of enjoyment and excitement to the way this new NHL season unfolds.
Yeah, the Four Nations face-off, which will be in February there, Canada, U.S., Finland, and Sweden. And then, of course, the Olympics not too far off as well. We'll see how that all shakes out. Always a blast. So, yeah, very good cup final. We could be headed for a good World Series. We'll see. It's at least a very fun playoff race. Maybe closer than we anticipated when we looked at the standings 2-3 weeks ago. You are down in Milwaukee for Phillies Brewers. Now, obviously, both of those teams have their playoff spots very locked up, have their divisions very locked up, but still some jockeying for, hey, who's going to get a bye through the first round and things like that. I was speaking with someone earlier this week, John. What is your sense of how the very good teams feel about the bye? Because obviously it's great to have 100% chance of making it to the second round. That's really, really good. I would not want to be in another best 2 of 3 series after what's happened in this city the last couple of years. But some people seem to think there is like a rust factor when you have to sit down for 4 or 5 days. What have you made of that over the couple years we've had this format?
Well, it's a great point, Blake. And for a strong argument to it, I present to you the 2023 World Series.
Yeah.
Brought to you by the Texas Rangers and the Arizona Diamondbacks, both of whom were playing in that wild card round, and then we're playing in the last game of the season. That's real. The rest versus rust conversation is very, very real. And now, in fairness, there have been teams that have played in that first round and have gone on to be able to win the World Series, or at least compete in the World Series, let's say, that have been part of the division series and had a bye. The Astros are one such example from just 2022. So it's not as though it is the sign that your season is about to be brought to an abrupt conclusion if you get the bye. But you have to have, I think, the right type of team to handle it. And the Astros handled it very well in 22 in a way that really we didn't see teams handling it necessarily having the bye last year, because as we just talked about, the two teams that were in the World Series were those that were competing from the very beginning and won those wild card series as the road team. So it's an interesting conversation point. I think that you're seeing some teams really limping towards the end. The Orioles are one such example. Mm-hmm. Midway through the year, we thought this team was as much of a favorite to win the World Series as anybody else. They have just not played good baseball in the second half, and even the concerns last night being raised again about Craig Kimbrel in the ninth inning. So it is somewhat team dependent, Blake, the way in which that delay would impact you. But I think last year we saw a resounding example that once you've gotten through, once you've gotten through that best of three, that in some ways you're on a really good trajectory. Because think about it, the pressure is on the homestanding team there. They've got the bye, they're at home, they've got the pressure of winning, and they haven't played in a week. Whereas you just won an emotional series, you're the underdog now, you've got nothing to lose, and that's a very dangerous kind of team to play.
It is, it's tough. It puts you in a situation where you don't want to be in the wild card because you've only got, you know, at best, and this is maybe probably exaggerated, like a 55-45 chance of getting through, even if you're the home team or whatever. Like, baseball's that random in a best 2 out of 3. The White Sox are going to win 35 games this year. You lose some. But once you get through, maybe you like your odds a little bit better once that's rolling, even though, you know, you've had to use an extra pitcher here and there. So you are there in Milwaukee. The Philadelphia Phillies are a team who have gone through the other side of it. They have been a wild card team. They will almost certainly lock up one of these buys this year. They have the best record in baseball right now by a 2-game margin here. What are you sensing from that team in terms of, well, one, they're very experienced and they've been through the wild card side of it. Two, the break lets them line up what's arguably the best rotation in the playoff field. Does this Phillies team look to you like a team that could take advantage of that break and be ready to roll here in 2 weeks?
I do. I think that a lot of it is similar to the Astros a couple years ago, Blake. It's the postseason experience in that clubhouse. You've got Kyle Schwarber, who's won a World Series title. You've got Bryce Harper, who, while he has not won the World Series title, has been in a World Series with this team 2 years ago and is certainly very familiar with what it takes to win in the month of October. There's a lot of depth there. JT Realmuto, veteran. There's just a lot of veteran know-how with this particular Phillies team. And I love that, by the way, tonight we could have a dual clinch scenario for us with our MLB Network game, because actually the Brewers, they could actually clinch off the field today. The Cubs play this afternoon. If the Cubs lose, the Brewers clinch in the afternoon. And then if the Phillies win the game tonight, both teams will have clinched today, which would be a pretty unique way to celebrate and have that all in front of us tonight. But I think one player that stands out to me, Blake, that really would benefit, I believe, from a little bit of a break is Harper. Because Harper, by his own admission, has been dealing with elbow issues and wrist issues on the field. He hasn't been hitting like it because he's had a tremendous run here in the last several weeks. He's played the last 27 games in a row. His OPS is close to 1,000 during that time. So he is grinding through it. We began this conversation talking a little hockey. He's approaching it like a hockey player. He's like, I'll talk to you in November about how much I'm hurting, but right now I've got a game. And I think that's the way that he's been handling things. And Harper, as you know, great hockey fan, and is, I think, embodying that ethos very nicely for the great Canadian manager, Rob Thompson.
And even when they were here a couple of weeks ago, he very clearly was dealing with an elbow thing. He was wincing a little bit after a couple swings and things like that. And there was no sense whatsoever of like, yeah, he's not missing a game. He's not sitting out. Maybe when we lock it up, he'll sit down for a game or so. But yeah, so that's cool to see. On the Brewers side, it's been kind of a boring National League Central race. Like they've been the team that's clearly going to win the division for a long time now. And I know they lost Christian Yelich and they don't have the deepest of playoff rotations. Do you feel like it's been a little quiet about the Brewers when we talk about the playoff fields and things like that? It seems like, you know, both from a model perspective, an odds perspective, a discussion perspective, the Brewers are just kind of there in the National League. And maybe that's, they've had the division locked up. The Phillies and Dodgers are marquee teams. The wild card race is fun. And then the Brewers are just kind of sitting there. How threatening do you think they could be come playoff time?
Very threatening. And I think to your point, Blake, that their journey to this juncture has been much more difficult than the standings would have you believe. Because while they have a comfortable lead, this has not been a comfortable season. Christian Yelich, to your point, out for the year. Devin Williams did not begin the year on the active roster due to injury. You look at last year's rotation. Corbin Burns is an Oriole. Brandon Woodruff's out for the year. So all of these different reasons you look at and say, wow, this team has overcome a lot, even though Pat Murphy, who might be the manager of the year, has made it look rather easy. And it's not been easy. We're actually talking about different discussion points we could have on the broadcast tonight. And I was just sharing with our producer, Bill Bolin, that I think it's interesting that on Fangraphs.com, only one National League team has multiple players among the top 10 most valuable in the NL this year. And that team is the Brewers. Those players are William Contreras and Willie Adames, who have the numbers of superstars. But I think that if you talk to the casual fan, they probably don't really have a full appreciation for how great they both are. And William Contreras, excellent behind the plate, excellent offensively. Willie Adames is going to make a lot of money in free agency. He's one of the premier shortstops in our sport. So I think they're a very underrated, great roster. They've had 12 different pitchers record saves this season. 12, including one on Monday, Colin Ray, who has been, oddly, one of their most consistent starting pitchers this season. So it's... Blake, it's a team that has had to get very creative, and I think that you've got to credit Pat Murphy and their leadership group on the field as well for making it through to this point.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. And yeah, the rotation, you know, Freddie Peralta and Tobias Myers have been good, but it's been just trying a bunch of stuff outside of that. And obviously this is an organization that has developed players pretty well, but just maybe not there yet in terms of that pitching depth, like Jacob Misurowski, who, you know, we probably won't see until next season at this point and things like that. So it's been fascinating to see them cobble it together and turn that bullpen into really, like, at least numbers-wise, like a pretty good bullpen for a group of, oh, that guy. Oh, Joel Piamps is still around. Oh, right. Joe Ross
former
is still
J.
around.
Former J. Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly. There was a moment, Blake, just I want to mention quickly. Earlier on this year, I think it was maybe in June, when Pat Murphy was doing an interview on MLB Network Radio about the Brewers' bullpen. And he mentioned somewhat casually, yeah, as of today, every active reliever we have has been DFA'd before. Now, this is pre-Devin Williams coming back. But still, this was in the first half of the year with not an insignificant number of games already having been played. That was his bullpen. It was the all DFA'd All-Stars, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. But again, there's always volatility with relievers, and I get it. But that's a great job, not just by Pat Murphy, but also pitching coach Chris Hook and their front office to identify the kinds of players who had maybe struggled elsewhere, including, again, Joel Piamps and others who could have something to give to the Brewers. So I just think that was one of the notes that I just could not believe. I said, wait a minute, is that true? Everybody had been DFA'd, and yeah, Pat Murphy was spot on. It's an amazing achievement for the manager, for the pitching coach in the front office.
And if you are a Toronto Blue Jays fan and you're like, why do they keep claiming guys? Why is Nick Robertson here? Why is Luis Frias in the bullpen and things like that? The Jays have cycled through, I believe, 14 relievers now on their 40-man who were not on the roster to start the season. Now, they have not had nearly the success that the Milwaukee Brewers have had turning those guys into productive relievers. It looks like maybe only a couple of them might stick, but 14 guys they've churned through. This is why, because if you can find one or two out of that churn, it's worthwhile. I wanted to come back to Willy Adames there, John. Obviously, he is having a tremendous year, 32 homers. He's probably going to finish with 20 stolen bases. He's going to be close to that 5-win above replacement mark, and he's been doing this for a few years now. You mentioned there might not be – every baseball fan might not know who Willy Adames is or be able to pick him out. They're going to see the headlines this offseason. Just how big do you think that payday could be for Willy Adames? He's going to be with Matt Chapman off the market, you know, after Bregman, maybe the top infield name.
I agree. And look at the extension that Matt Chapman just signed with the Giants, and then ask yourself, okay, premium defender at the premium infield position, shortstop. So even one spot over from Chapman, closer to second base, which typically we see teams always prioritize the shortstop position. Line up his numbers and compare his numbers to Chapman's numbers, and then ask yourself, as a true free agent, not an extension, but a true free agent, he's going to probably get basically Chapman's deal, maybe even a little bit better than that. It's a massive payday, a nine-figure payday for Willy Adames. And you consider the number of teams that might be looking for a shortstop or shortstop help. The Dodgers are one that I think really comes to mind. There's obviously a Tampa Bay Rays connection there going way back. And obviously it's been some number of years now since Andrew Friedman was in Tampa. And actually that was right around the time, of course, that he left the Rays. It was after that Willy Adames trade, part of the David Price deal, by the way, originally to the Tigers. So a year before he got traded to the Jays, that was how Adames became a Ray. And then, of course, became a Brewer. So I think that for a lot of reasons, I look at that pairing as being a really natural one with the Dodgers, unless, and I'm sure we'll talk about Bo at some point, Bo Bichette's there and is maybe a very interesting option. We'll see how that shortstop position gets handled for the Dodgers and again for the Jays going forward. But I think this is all part of the Bo conversation and why I'm sure teams will be talking about him in the winter, because there are not a lot of really elite level shortstops out there and available in free agency. And for all the teams that don't sign Adames, that will be the natural pivot point to say, hey, let's call Ross Atkins. Let's see just how available Bo is, because I do believe that number for Adames is going to be astronomical. It's going to be up into the nine figures there, and we'll see what that means for the rest of the shortstop market.
And it also will set maybe the market for if Bo Bichette has a good free agent walk year next year, right? Like, that's going to be right. The comp that they could point to. And yeah, Bo will have the bad 2024 on there, but might at that point be able to chalk it up to injury and things like that. So yeah, that'll be pretty fascinating. Just to clarify and follow up on that. So Bo returned last night. He has obviously done the PR work over the last couple of weeks, and I'm sure he means it. So I don't mean to be glib about it, but I want to be here. I had time to reflect, and I'm so grateful, and I want to be here and win with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and things like that, which is nice to hear. But your read on this is that teams around baseball will still call and see just how legitimate and how much both sides feel that way about the fit there?
Without question. Without question. I think, and to your point, I'm not at all doubting Bo's interest in staying in Toronto, but what he said recently to Shai, and it was a great story that Shai had, is exactly what he had to say. Because when you think about it, he's a more valuable player to everybody if he's happy, right? So if you're the Jays, if he were to come out and say the opposite, let's take the opposite case here. And then he said to Shai, hey, I'm ready to move on, so to speak. Well, that diminishes his trade value. Then the Jays have a harder time getting fair value for him. But given what he has said, and that he's on record as saying, hey, I'm happy staying in Toronto, I want to stay in Toronto, that makes him more valuable, because then the Jays don't feel like they have to trade him. At least outwardly, the idea is that he's not, that they would not be trading him under duress. And again, let's see how he plays the next couple of weeks. He was 2-for-5 last night. Good. It's a good start. So if he shows over the next couple of weeks that he's healthy again, then either the Jays say, okay, we believe in you now more, I suppose, and we can see a way that you're part of our long-term future. Or it would not surprise me, and I'm not in Texas right now, but it would not surprise me at all, Blake, if there were scouts all over the place in Texas right now. Because if you're a team that's maybe either potentially going for a postseason berth, as the Dodgers would, or another team that wants to upgrade at shortstop, you're looking at him right now to see what you could potentially get and what you're seeing in his actions, how he's handling himself, what are his nonverbals like, all these things. Saying what he said to Shai is important. Putting up numbers is more important. And then how scouts and how his own team sees him interacting is probably most important, and really discerning and divining where his headspace is, where he's at physically. Again, it's 2 weeks and you can't really be swayed too much by that, but him showing that he's healthy is a really important way, not just for the Jays to see him and to base their potential long-term financial comfort with him, but also other teams. And at this time of year, there's no trade deadline to prepare for. You're preparing for the offseason. I'm sure a lot of teams in the industry are watching Bo Bichette's at-bats and his defensive work very carefully for the next couple
of
weeks.
Yeah, a couple of infield hits yesterday. They were cheapies, but you take them where you can get them first game back and to get those on the board. John, I'm running long with you, so apologies for this, but quickly before I let you go, the Detroit Tigers have won 8 of 10 and 17 of 24. They are now only a game and a half out of that final wild card spot. You getting some Michigan playoff baseball for the first time since 2014?
Hey, it's possible. And when you think about it, the Twins and their struggles are part of this conversation. Now, to be fair, the Twins have the tiebreaker. So it's not as though it's quite as close as it looks, but the Tigers are making it interesting. My friends and family are texting me about it. They're excited. So I think that, listen, they end the year with the White Sox at home. Those should be wins, of course. They play the Rays next week at home. The Rays are out of it now. They're going to play the Orioles this weekend. They're struggling. You can talk yourself into believing this. It's not terribly far-fetched. And I think it's just amazing that the Tigers sold at the deadline and somehow are where they're at right now. And I think part of the reason why they're playing well, when we talk about young shortstops, Trey Sweeney has come in, and he was part of that Jack Flaherty deal. He's making an impact. So I believe, Blake. It's my home state team. I've got to say that I believe, and I do.
And then there's Tyler Holden, who hasn't allowed an earned run since like the Lou Whitaker era, it feels like,
right.
Lately.
The best reliever nobody's talking about nationally, except for Blake, because you do your homework. So Good job.
John, thanks so much for taking the time out. I will root for the Tigers for your friends and family in the Michigan era.
All right. Tigers in the World Series, Leafs in the Cup Final. Let's make it happen.
There we go. Perfect. John Morosi of MLB Network, of NHL Network. We're going to take a break. When we come back on the other side, we will talk to Chris Black, producer at Sportsnet. David Schneider, red hot. It's been a career so far, and what works out to about one full season of data with one of the highest highs in the history of the Blue Jays and some of the lowest lows in the history of the Blue Jays. What's changed? What's he locked in on here a little bit to turn things around? Bowden Francis will also start tonight. He will go head-to-head with Cody Bradford. We'll get you ready for that one. Bradford, a bit of a throwback. 90 miles an hour, living on the edges. Doesn't walk anyone, but not going to blow you away with his stuff. Bowden Francis, of course, on an absolute heater right now. We'll set all that up. We'll also talk to Brent LaValle, manager of the Vancouver Canadiens, who went to the Northwest League Final. That's the Blue Jays' high A affiliate. Some good Kendry Rojas stuff, Jaron Watts-Brown, Adrian Pinto, who you might remember from the Ryan Tapia Randall Grichuk trade. He got healthy late in the year and was a big boost for that Canadiens team. So we'll talk about all of that as well. Chris Black next as Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet 360.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. I feel like I should say Chris Black doesn't have headphones in. This was not a Tribe Called Quest playing you back. We're not on radio. We're only on Sportsnet 360, Sportsnet Plus, and the website today and podcast. And we can only use the music on the radio side. So you don't get it. Was supposed to be a Tribe Called Quest for you, though. So I apologize.
As long as my grandmother can still watch on television,
absolutely.
That's all that matters.
She can absolutely watch. She's probably watching right now. Hello to Chris's grandmother. Hello to you, man. It's been a little while here. You had tennis stuff and then obviously been on the road with the Jays a little bit. How you been doing?
Really well. I actually have really enjoyed watching this team over the last little bit. I think there's a lot of storylines. It's been interesting to watch. I almost feel like somehow there was like a low point in the season. I don't remember exactly where it was, but like where it was like, Maybe they should just restart. But seeing Vladdy ascend, seeing like the positive returns from guys like Horwitz, from Wagner, seeing Bowden Francis do what he's done, like there's actually stuff to like be like, okay, no, like there are ways we can, you know, you can envision something working in 2025, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And you know, I'm coming off a Raptors season where the seasons were similar, obviously for different reasons and different places, and the Raptors made more significant organizational changes. But by the end of that year, when they had traded guys away and 4/5 of the starting rotation were also injured or out due to personal reasons, like I was watching guys that I wasn't that high on in the G League come up and play 30 minutes in a game. Whereas with this Blue Jays team, these are guys who, no, you're not going to change who you're going out and getting in free agency because Will Wagner looked good for a couple weeks, but you're a lot more certain that you don't have to go out and spend to fortify the bench. You have a bench internally. You're going to have 40-man depth at the AAA level because everyone except for Leo Jimenez and Ernie Clement, who's going to be in these battles, all those guys are optionable and things like that. So it's been more fun, and then it's also more meaningful. And it's not just these guys have been okay. Avery from Gay14 tweeted out earlier today that since the All-Star break, the Jays are the number two offense against right-handed pitching because they now have some lefties and things like that. I know you and I think Mike Petriello had a conversation recently on Twitter about the Jays being the best team, the best offense in baseball over the last like 45 days now by weighted runs created plus. Because again, they have the platoon advantage. They have guys who are actually hitting. Vlad's been on this sustained heater, et cetera. So this stuff is also meaningful.
Yeah, I really think it is. Yeah, Mike reached out. I think he was working Blue Jay Central that day. He's like, I really don't like using stuff I find on Twitter sometimes, but is it cool? And I was like, yeah, obviously. I steal stuff from him all the time for when I'm producing his shows or when I'm producing Blue Jay Central. So, I think there is stuff. I think everyone around this team, whether it's coaches, players, executives, media, whoever, I think most of us are really pragmatic about it. it, like you said, it doesn't change the shopping list. It really doesn't change that. We all kind of know what is on that list and what needs to be done. But like you said, like, I think it's much easier to fill out the rest of the roster after you go shopping for the big ticket items. Now, I think you've got more people that you're willing to give a shot to, that you didn't necessarily, that weren't in the mix a couple months ago. So in that respect, watching this team has been, like, as I said, like, a little bit, has been pretty refreshing over the last few weeks.
Yeah, it's good. And yeah, it, with respect to Mike, a little upset that he used the Leo Jimenez hit by a pitch topic last night on Blue Jay Central. Yeah, I wanted it for today. I'm on, it's okay. We're going to do some CanCon a little later in that elite Guardians bullpen. So that's where I've focused instead. I stole Cade Smith from his relievers rundown since he took Leo off of my play. And then, of course, Leo Jimenez gets hit by a pitch last night. What was the stat you tweeted out about Leo Jimenez getting hit by a pitch earlier?
He's at, so far in his career, close to 8% of his plate appearances have finished in a hit by pitch. That is the highest rate in MLB history. Obviously, hashtag small samples, but yeah, like, it's, no one gets hit. No one ever in the history of Major League Baseball has gotten hit more often on a per plate appearance basis than Leo Jimenez.
Yeah, and it's not new to the major league level. He's been hit by 14 pitches in 54 games. He was hit by 15 in 57 games at AAA this year. He also has seasons of 17 and 25 in the minor leagues. And obviously, he got, like, in 2021, there was only 59 games that he got into. And maybe this is because he got hit so much. He got hit 25 times in 59 games. Like, this is obviously a skill. And Michael Bauman of Fangraphs had a piece on hit-by-pitch guys, Brendan Guyer being the guy from Cleveland and Tampa Bay a couple years ago who, you know, was on a pace basis threatening Craig Biggio's record and things like that. Reed Johnson, obviously the Toronto Blue Jay guy I associate with hit-by-pitch. I don't know if that's true for you as well.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So there is, like, there is a skill to it. And anyway, the stat in Michael Bauman's piece is that over 9% of pitches that miss the plate on the inside part of the plate, Leo Jimenez gets hit by. And that is way higher than anyone else in baseball and, like, five times the league average. To what degree do you think this is, like, a learnable skill versus, like, a guy innately is tight to the plate mechanically and is willing to not get out of the way? Like, I think about, like, what if Ernie Clement got hit 15 times a year and that's how you solve the OBP issue? Suddenly Ernie's like an unquestioned everyday player.
I think it's primarily just due to the mechanics or the setup of his swing. That close stance, he dives in. Like, if you look at, like, when the pitch is crossing the plate, if you freeze the frame there, he is, like, the front foot is nearly touching the inside part of the plate. The elbow is hanging right over the inside corner, and he offers at it kind of the way that, like, Danny Jansen always used to hurt himself by, like, throwing his hands towards it as well. Thankfully, Jimenez has avoided, like, his hands getting hit. He really sticks.
Although he did miss a game the other day with the finger contusion.
Like, yeah, like, there is a little bit of the, like, I don't want to dive too far in, but, like, he sticks out that elbow pad a little bit. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point, if this keeps up and the book gets out on him, that some team is going to give a heads up to the umpires before the game and will say, we're throwing inside on this guy. And if he doesn't, like, attempt to get away over a pitch that's over the plate, like, call him. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if that kind of scenario pops up. Maybe not this year. Maybe it's early next year. But, yeah, he's aggressive with how he steps towards the plate.
Yeah, if you did that this season, the Jays have 11 games left, none of them against playoff relevant competition. Correct. I would call out loser behavior if you complained about that in the last little bit here. Okay, not loser behavior. David Schneider is back. He's on a heater. He had one. He had that big hit last week against the Mets. Hitless game after that, but in the time since, he's put up 7 hits over 3 games, including a home run in 3 consecutive games. David Schneider, we've got almost exactly one season worth of data on David Schneider now. He has played in 160 major league games, which is a nice tidy point to check in on him after 2 partial seasons here. What have you seen? Some very high highs and some, like, historic lows as well. Where are you on David Schneider and what maybe he's been able to do these last couple games?
Yeah, I really It's the lowest of the lows. Like, it really is. If you look at, he's had the lowest OPS in a 25 game span of any player in Blue Jays history.
Crazy. And one of the highest.
And one of the highest last year. Like, in, and like, also, if you even look at 50 game span, like a 50 game span, the only guy lower in an OPS by the Jays is Manny Lee. And again, like, that's a guy, that's a premium defensive position. So you're almost like you're allowing more leeway for poor offense. So with Schneider, to look at like to have a 254 OPS in a 25 game sample, or like close to a like a 340 or a 350 over a 50 game sample, I do say without the high of last season and without playing a premium position, a guy like that would have been sent to the minors. Yes. And I know some people are well calling for it, but the highs of 2023 are what kept him up here, I think. That, you know, they saw, we've all seen what he can do. I do think, like, it's, there are only so many people, we said, like, among the highest, like, the list of guys who have put up a better 25-game OPS in terms of the Jays are, like, it's all the best Jays you've ever, it's Bautista, Olerud, Encarnacion, Donaldson, and, like, the guys who haven't put up, Bo Bichette's never had a 25-game sample as good as David Schneider's. George Springer has never had one. Roberto Alomar never had one. Paul Molitor never had one. So, like, he's reached highs that only a certain amount of people in baseball can hit. So I do think what he did last year was he was on an insanely hot streak. He was selling out for things. I think that's what we all liked about him, that, you know, when he saw a pitch he wanted to go after, he was back-legging it, to quote Mr. Barker. Yeah. He was trying to pull the ball, trying to get up in the air. No matter where it was, that was his MO. And I think what happened over the last year is as the book got out on him, teams realized how to neutralize that, yeah, how to neutralize that kind of desire and that all-in approach. And I think the last month or two, even though it's, even though those severe lows have kind of coincided with it, I think it's like been him working on creating an approach that isn't so, that can, that isn't so up and down, that isn't so variable. So I think what's been really encouraging is that to see him get so many hits and not, well, not a ton of hits, but like when he's been popping out of it, out of this slump, hits to the big part of the field, hits the center field, hits the right center. And then finally last night, an inside fastball. Yeah. So those are the pitches you should try and turn on, cheat on, and pull the left field. That's what he did. So,
and you're not going to get those unless you're taking other stuff the other way, you're not, and showing exactly that you can hit the outer third.
Exactly. You've got to show you're willing to go the other way in order to get those pitches. So I do think it's really encouraging what we've seen in the last 3 weeks. And I do think without what he did last year, he probably would have been in Buffalo at some point.
Yeah, and I think even if the team were just a bit more competitive, he probably would have been down there, because you can't. Although Manny Lee did hit 170 during the 1992 playoff run. So if David Schneider had become a very good defensive shortstop, then he probably would have stuck around. But yeah, had the team been a little more competitive. So when it comes to projecting David Schneider forward, obviously we have a full season's worth of data now where his OPS is 742. So about 10% better than league average at the plate by weighted runs created plus. But obviously, you know, second base and left field, where he's probably below average defensively in those. Although he's made a couple of nice plays in left field recently.
He's made a few nice plays.
He actually had a magnet for the wall lately.
He's not super fast. His jumps are around average. But what I like about him is there seems to be, this isn't quantifiable, there seems to be a determination when he's going after a ball that, like, and if he can get to it, he's going to make a play. Like, so I do like that part of it. Like, there is like a competitiveness to the way he plays the outfield. So in that respect, I do think he's around average.
Statcast and Fangraphs both have him slightly above average defensively, yeah, on the season.
That's, I think, about where I would place him. I think there were some shaky moments last year. I think he's improved. So I'm not hashtag nervous when he's in the outfield compared to some other guys.
So second base, left field, obviously DH is a potential option as well. The guys who figure to be competing for Blue Jays bench spots next year are pretty lefty heavy. Ernie and Leo Jimenez are righties, and neither of those guys have options. So that's a relevant factor there in David Schneider's options. But the rest of these guys, Loperfido, Barger, Wagner, there are a bunch of lefties in the mix there. I guess Jonathan Clase is a switch hitter, but another guy who could hit for this. So the potential desire to have one of the bench pieces be a right-handed bat is there. Where are you kind of level setting on Davis Schneider when we look into 2025? Obviously, none of these guys are going to, you know, have jobs locked up necessarily. But, you know, is he in the mix for a bench spot for you? Is he in the mix for the right-handed hitting side of a platoon? Like, what do you make of what camp will look like for Schneider next year in terms of opportunity?
The last 2 years he's earned a right, like whatever those numbers are through 160 games. Those are good numbers. Like no matter, even with the lows, they're good major league numbers. So he's earned the right to compete for a spot. I do think next spring, like what we were talking about off the top about the last few weeks being really interesting, the, you know, the progression of that interest and the progression of that kind of those stories is the 2025 spring is shaping up to be the most interesting one in the Toronto Blue Jays camp as it's been in years. Because I think a lot of spots, depending on trades and signings, like I think a lot of spots are going to be up for grabs. Like I don't know how many of these, all those guys you mentioned actually have spots won. Like I think Spencer Horwitz has probably earned a spot if he's here, if he doesn't get moved. I think probably Ernie Clement, but again, who knows? Like I think a guy like Schneider is going to be competing for a spot. He's earned it, but I don't think anything's guaranteed. And that has everything to do with how good and all these other guys are and what they've shown and what a guy like Will Wagner has shown. Even a guy like Nathan Lucas, what he's showing.
That's the other lefty I didn't name.
Yeah. Lo Perfido, they're high on. Like every time you kind of hear talk about him, you hear how high the team is on him. So I think he's going to get every shot to win a spot. So I think there's a lot of potential stories. I also think like all those names you just listed, there isn't enough spots for all of them.
Right.
And at least one or two signings from the non-catcher variety. So when you base at least one new guy coming into that mix, if not two, I think it's pretty safe to say it feels like at least one of these guys is going to get traded, if not a couple.
And maybe that's how you help address the bullpen. You know, you probably lose on a value basis,
correct,
turning a bench slash platoon player into a reliever, but you know, is it helpful to you to have four guys down at AAA on the 40 man that you could call up who don't need the developmental reps?
Yeah, that's exactly where I land on it.
Okay. And then the other note on as it pertains to Lo Perfido and Nathan Lucas, and I guess to some extent Jonathan Clase, who had four hits yesterday, including a stolen base, and he steals a base every game now that he has his feet under him with Buffalo. Dalton Varsho is done for the year. He's going to have surgery to repair a small tear in his right rotator cuff, and his ability to be ready for 2025 spring training is at least a little bit in question until they get in there and see how it's recovering. That framing makes it sound like, okay, you're not going to miss him for a big chunk of the year. So let's only focus on the Dalton Varsho part of this. Did he do enough, considering the center field, left field split that happens with the Gold Glove voting, to finally get a Gold Glove?
I think it'll depend on the voters. Personally, I think he has done enough. I think the body of work, like I don't think he's dominated in any one position. And by some metrics, Duran has actually passed him in center field.
Defensive run saved has Duran ahead because, again, we can.
Yeah.
The Gold Glove statistical component will not Varsho's time in left field. So Duran hasn't beat there. If we include center field and left field, Varsho has everyone beat.
Yeah, and I do think if we've learned anything from Gold Glove voting over the years, even as it's gotten smarter over the last few years, I still think it's a bit of a, it's not unlike the Emmys or the Oscars. Like, it's a bit slow to react. So, you know, sometimes you're getting awarded for a body of work, or sometimes you're getting awarded for a couple years of work where you've probably deserved it but haven't won it. So I actually think Varsho's ahead of Duran in terms of the league recognition and that sort of thing. So I do think he is going to win one. I think enough people have been talking about it. Enough people have seen his play. He certainly earned it. It is kind of crazy to just look at any kind of numbers already, like just forget about splitting the positions. Just look at what he's done this season. Defensive metrics are not perfect, even the most up-to-date ones, even right now. But even Baseball Reference has a way of calculating defensive value. It's not perfect, but it creates pretty satisfying lists. And one of the things that it said is only Devon White in 1992 has put up a better defensive season than Dalton Varsho. That's very satisfying. It passes the smell test for all of us. When you look at that, it does feel like, yeah, I think this guy probably deserves a gold glove, and I actually do think he's going to win one.
I hope he does. I hope you're right. Ernie Clement and Alejandro Kirk both have cases as well. Clement, I don't know how you qualify for utility man. He might not have enough done at third base, but third base in the American League this year is a wasteland.
Yeah,
it's a lot of guys with partial seasons and things like that. So it'll be interesting. A bad Jays team gets a bunch of defensive accolades. Okay, no good defense yesterday behind Chris Bassitt. He gives up 7 runs, only one of them earned, so it doesn't kill the, you know, actually his ERA comes out lower than he went in, but obviously not a good start. It's been an interesting year for Bassitt where there was the very bad start and then a really sustained 9 or 10 stretch start of being excellent. And now, you know, not closing quite as well as Kevin Gausman, Jose Berríos, and Bauta Francis have. This is a guy who has pitched so many innings the last few years. Does it in a way that is not how we conventionally look at top pitchers, given that he throws 8 different pitches and doesn't throw crazy hard and you know, the durability is a factor. Where are you level setting on Chris Bassitt for 2025, where he'll be, you know, by his own admission to Shai and Arden when they caught up with him about what those quotes had meant on the podcast he was on? You know, he can't reverse aging, can't reverse the innings log and things like that. What do you think we see from Chris Bassitt next year?
Bassitt's a really interesting case for a few different reasons, because there's like some like almost like conflicting factors. So you got a couple things, like you mentioned the innings. So he's at like 500 plus innings over the last 3 years. There aren't very many pitchers over the last 10, 15 years who have logged that many innings in ages 33, 34, 35. So when you look at that sample of guys, and that might be like 15 or 20 guys, you get a real like mishmash of like how guys did in their age 36 seasons. You get a Justin Verlander who wins a Cy Young, but I don't think Bassitt doesn't fit into that cohort. You get some guys who are retiring. You get some guys with some bad seasons. You get some guys with some good ones. Where Bassitt really kind of separates himself from that group is he doesn't actually have a lot of miles on the odometer when you look at career innings. So even though he's thrown a lot of innings in the last few years, he's kind of a late bloomer. Didn't really get started until really established himself until the last maybe 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. So he's only got, I don't know the exact number, but I want to say like 1,100 or 1,200 career innings.
1,104.
Yeah. So like, it's not a ton of, he hasn't.
Reliever in college too.
Yeah. He hasn't used a ton of bullets career wise. He has used a lot lately. And he's not a guy who relies on elite velocity to succeed. Now, we've seen the whiff rate is at a career low. Chase is kind of leveled off. Strikeout rate's kind of leveled off. So there are, you know, when you talked about kind of the variability in his performance, that kind of ties into losing swing and miss, losing strikeouts. Having said all that, the one guy that kind of popped out as a reasonable comp was Bronson Arroyo. So a guy, again, who logged a lot of innings, 33, 34, 35, wasn't an elite velo guy, different pitches, a bit of finesse, a savvy pitcher, and he was pretty good in 36 and 37. Had
yeah,
a couple
379
more,
ERA in his age 36 season.
Yeah, had a couple more decent seasons. I think Bassitt's past the point of, I don't even know if he ever was truly an ace, but like he was definitely a good number two at one point. I'm confident that, like, because of his knowledge of the game, because he is like, we've dubbed him the professor a few times, like, I think he'll figure out a way to be productive, to remain productive for another year or two. Obviously, knock on wood, like, health permitting. But that, when I looked at the historical comps and when I looked at, again, the miles on the odometer, that kind of like gave me a reference of like, okay, yeah, like, I actually do think he's got a few more bullets than maybe I initially thought.
Okay, well, that is encouraging, because the Jays are obviously going to rely heavily on Kevin Gausman, Chris Bassitt, and Jose Berríos next year to repeat the health they've had, repeat the workloads they've had. Kevin Gausman, the velocity ticking up lately, pretty encouraging. The starting rotation has not been the problem. Kevin Gausman, a 402. Chris Bassett, a 416. Barrios, a 344. Kikuchi, obviously good before he left. Even Yariel Rodriguez and Bowden Francis, guys who weren't supposed to be in the rotation necessarily, 429 and 350 ERAs, respectively. Like, the rotation hasn't been maybe what it was the last 2 years.
But I think I know where you're going with
it's
this.
It's been pretty good. The bullpen is enough that, like, you mentioned earlier how pragmatic you tend to be about things. That you texted me something yesterday about the bullpen that is like the most extreme baseball to take I think I've you and it wasn't even that extreme. You're just always so level headed. You went into basketball Chris Black mode. we're talking about this bullpen. Man, obviously this is such a huge component of how wrong things went this year. And there's the Springer stuff and the Bobichet stuff. There's a lot. They didn't score enough runs as well. How do you contextualize when you look toward 2025 that this was not only the worst bullpen season in Blue Jays history by far, but like arguably in the last 20 years of baseball?
Yeah, like there's no, it's interesting because there isn't a perfect way to measure a bullpen's performance.
Right, because if you're bad, the leverage isn't that high and like ERA is imperfect.
Can you do win probability added? Yes, but that depends. That's very dependent on team success. ERA isn't even perfect, but I that's somewhat helpful. There's, you know, you can just look at peripheral factors like strikeout rate and home run rate, which the Blue Jays bullpen is not great at all. But like an easy way, again, a catch-all, nothing's perfect, but a catch-all metric, you can just look at wins above replacement. And so I pulled back 20 years of data, 20 full seasons of data. So 600 bullpens. The top bullpens in the league, single seasons in that time were worth about 9 wins above replacement, 9-10 wins. That's a lot for a bullpen because it's actually hard to be valuable as an individual bullpen pitcher. Way more value starting pitchers, position players. So to like accumulate 9 or 10 wins above replacement for a bullpen, that's very, very good.
For context, Cleveland, who have quite like by numbers and by everyone's feel of it, that bullpen has been worth 7.5 wins above replacement this year.
Yeah, really, really good.
And they have a 267 ERA over almost like 600 innings.
Yeah, the Blue Jays bullpen this year is a -3 WAR. And that is like among, I believe there's only out of those 600 bullpens over the last 20 full seasons in Major League Baseball, only one or two have posted lower wins above replacement. So again, imperfect way of measuring. There are no perfect ways of measuring a bullpen, but by performance, by, you know, when you adjust for league and park factors, this bullpen has just performed really, really poorly. And it, again, none of us were expecting this. Like I think the last time I was here, which might've been like 3 weeks ago or a month ago, I think we discussed a similar point where it's like, if you thought the season wasn't going to go well, that's fine. None of you thought it was going to be based primarily because of the bullpen's performance.
Yeah, arguably the worst bullpen since the 2013 Houston Astros, who were firmly tanking and churning relievers, I think with the express purpose of losing extra games. That was a 51-win Astros team.
Yeah, and it's crazy because like the Romano went wrong. Swanson went wrong, didn't get off to the right foot. All these little things, Mesa ran out of bullets. Some injuries, some ineffectiveness, and all the options that they brought up to try and help, none of them hit. So it's just
and
like,
you can predict some of that. You could have looked at Romano, Swanson, and Mesa and be like, there are multiple years of each of these guys. You know, Mesa had some underlying indicators. Like if one of these guys is bad and ends up DFA'd or something, like not all that surprising for one of your three leverage guys to not be that good. But for all three of them to be not good / injured / both, and then everyone except Jimmy Garcia, and Chad Green was in there, but he's obviously regressed back to where we expected from Chad Green. Everyone who comes up, like you look at the way, I was just talking with John Morosi and the Milwaukee Brewers bullpen prior to Devin Williams coming back off the aisle early in the year. It was a very good bullpen and every reliever in that bullpen had been DFA'd at some point.
Yeah, it's
these guys like Kirby Yates closed out yesterday's game and has bounced around. Now he's a good closer. Like to have all of that misfortune in reliever randomness and zero positive accidental bullpen success stories is pretty outlier.
Yeah, it's I use a few too many gambling references on this site or on this platform, but it feels like you're on a shoe of blackjack and you lost like 10 hands in a row, like or 15 hands in a row. Or like the law of probabilities, like, this can't be happening.
I know the face cards are in there somewhere. It's a bullpen.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so it feels very unlucky. I don't know what you could have done differently to kind of buffer yourself other than just have more potential options in AAA. But it's interesting to look at. Wait, you mentioned Cleveland, which I thought was interesting, because if you look at, take the bullpens away from both those teams, look at the starting rotations and the position player group, you can make an argument that Toronto has a better team, that the almost the entire difference between those two teams
is the 10.5-11 wins in the bullpen.
Is the bullpen, right? Like, and leverage moments, and there's a few different things, but like, really, like, that's how much as I just said, like, bullpens can't really affect all that much, at least from a statistical point of view, they can really tank a season or push your season far. And Cleveland has seen that, you know, 8-10 years ago with the Andrew Miller led bullpen, the Kansas City Royals, which the Blue Jays saw in 15.
I have no memory of that.
They took a strong bullpen. Like, the bullpen almost led their team to a World Series, right? So, like, that sort of extreme on the other side can absolutely carry a team. And what we're seeing this year is that it can absolutely tank a season as well. It's not the only reason, but it's hard. In my opinion, it's the biggest reason for this season going the way it did. If you literally just had an average to or an expected season from this bullpen and an average or expected season from Bo Bichette, I think just those two factors, this team's competing for a playoff spot or a wild card spot.
Well, yeah, and it's extra frustrating that it's gone the way it has, because the Minnesota Twins don't seem to want that final wild card spot. It seems like 85 wins is going to be enough to maybe get you into that final wild card spot. I don't imagine the barrier to the wild card will be that light again anytime soon, given how good the good teams are, and the fact that, like, Cleveland and Minnesota also have banger farm systems and things like that. This was a year to get in. Okay, we've got about 4 minutes left. When it comes to, I mean, that's a great summation of how the Jays got here, even though there was weirdly early in the year, even though the bullpen had a bad ERA, they had, like, blown very few games because there was a lot of, like, turning two-run deficits into four-run
that's
deficits.
Right.
What else are you taking from this season in terms of this? Because this is the last time we'll have you on for the year, in terms of how you need to build 2025. We all know they need a little bit more power. We know they need to go out and spend and add a couple impact pieces. But in terms of lessons from this year, based on specifically how it's gone, what are you taking away?
It's hard. Like, I always try to envision, like, if you were a decision maker, what would you do? And when it's the bullpen, like, I feel like that's almost easier when you're trying to fix one position or two positions or a starting pitcher hole. It's like, okay, we know what we need to go get. Let's go get it. When you need to fix or add four or five bullpen arms, it's two things. One, it's like, how do you know which guy is, you know, how do you know which blackjack hand is going to hit? How do you know when to up that bet?
You can't Oscars grind. Yeah. This is a deep blackjack cut. Sorry. You can't Oscars grind a bullpen and just keep doubling down.
How do you know? Yeah. How do you know when the count is right to, like, really up your bet? But, like, I think there are a lot of options in terms of bullpen ways of addressing it. I think there's going to be free agents. I think there's going to be internal options from AAA. As much as they didn't hit, like, the ones who were brought up didn't hit, I think there are other options who haven't came up yet. And I also think that the trade market is going to be there. I really think, you know, there are going to be teams who are going to willingly take steps back and who I'm not sure are going to compete and who have relievers who have maybe 1 year left of control. So I'm thinking, you know, the Ryan Helsleys. I'm thinking guys of that ilk, closers on bad teams, setup men on bad teams. I wouldn't be surprised if Oakland started teasing the entire league again about maybe making Mason Miller available. You can argue about the merits of making a trade like that when you're a team that won 70-something games, but it all depends on acquisition cost, right? So I think they're going to address the bullpen in each of those ways. I think they're going to give some internal candidates a shot. I think they're going to sign one or two free agents. I think they're going to trade for one or two as well.
Yeah, the other type of reliever to keep in mind is a guy who is making decent but not elite money through the arbitration process and on a smaller team. So I think, like, the Pirates are going to be pretty spicy next year, maybe. But David Bednar is probably going to get, like, $6 million in arbitration. He's had a bad year and has 4 years of track record of being very good before that. That's a guy who maybe the acquisition cost is not that bad because he's coming off a bad year and the Pirates don't want to pay $6 million if he's not going to be their ninth inning guy or something like that. So guys like that on smaller teams. This is this is the time of year where you start looking at the broke boy franchises and, oh, the White Sox want to cut payroll. They have no good players, but every bullpen has one or two guys.
Lunch yesterday consisted of baseball reference tabs on all the bottom five or six teams in the league, looking at every reliever and their contract status for next year. So it's like, I do think bullpen is the biggest thing to look at. And outside of that, I mentioned those two factors. It's Bo Bichette. It's getting some clarity on his status moving forward, on his season. Is he back? What kind of shape is he in? What kind of play, can he perform at a 4 or 5 win level again? That's the biggest, to me, it's bullpen and shortstop. Those are the absolute biggest factors this offseason.
Mike Soroka, come on down on a low cost reliever. Can you get it right thing as well? Chris, thanks so much for taking the time out today and all season. I think this is the last time we'll have you on. So thanks so much.
Anytime.
Chris Black of Sportsnet at Down to Black on Twitter for all the terrific threads, which I'd imagine you'll retweet the Bowden Francis one today because Bowden Francis is on the Hill again. I neglected to bring that up, but we're running out of time. We got to take a break. And on the other side, we'll talk to Brent LaValle, manager of the High A Vancouver Canadiens, who went to a third consecutive championship series just this past weekend. Brent LaValle's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet 360.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A lot of Jays talk throughout the show today. They, of course, lost 13-8 last night. A lot of stuff around baseball. We didn't all get to go into too deep, like Jose Altuve showing feet to argue a hit by a pitch call and things like that. Let's see if Brent LaValle, manager of the Vancouver Canadiens, High A affiliate of the Toronto Blue Jays, has ever seen anything like that. Brent, good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. Doing well, thanks. How about yourself?
Pretty good. So I don't know if you got to see this or if you didn't catch a highlight. Jose Altuve took his cleats off last night and pointed to the umpire. Hey, this is where I got hit by a pitch. What do you mean I didn't get hit by a pitch? Have you ever seen anything like that? And if not, what is your favorite thing like that that's happened in an argument with an umpire?
Ooh, no, I don't think I've seen that one before. Saw the highlight of it, and yeah, I do believe that's the first time I've seen a player take his shoe and sock off. You know, I've seen the guy, a batter, take his batting glove off before, or even, you know, kind of show evidence of, you know, of an elbow getting hit or something like that. But no, nothing as extreme as a shoe and a sock.
Nothing. Luckily, none of you guys' games in the finals came down to a controversial hit by a pitch like that. Fun season for you guys wrapped this past weekend. I know we've talked to you before about how cool it is as a hometown guy to get to play those playoff games at the Nat. This was a third consecutive trip to the finals for you and the Vancouver Canadiens. How does that feel when you reflect on not just this year, but the last couple of years and the success you guys have been able to have?
Yeah, it's definitely positive memories thinking back. And our hitting coach, Ryan Wright, and I have been together for 3 years now in Vancouver, and I think it's over 400 games together. And every single game has mattered throughout our time there. And just a really, really special thing in minor league baseball with as many teams as there are, as many games as you play, to just be that consistent. And, you know, we don't play spectacular baseball every night, but, you know, I'd hope to say 90% of the time we're playing, 95% of the time we're playing really good baseball. And then it just comes down to the execution of whether you can beat the other team or not. So I think it has a lot to say about our process, preparation and planning, and you know, then we just let the boys go out there and do their thing.
Yeah, and it's not as if you could just like stack the roster or get lucky with the roster one time. This is 3 years in the minor leagues, dramatically different rosters, not just season to season, but even within the season. I think last time we talked to you, a couple of your guys had gotten the bump up to AA, which is obviously a win developmentally, but it's not like you guys can just rely on, hey, we're going to have these guys year after year after year. I know even like Desaun Brown, who had been there with you guys for a little bit, gets the call up shortly before playoffs. So kudos to you guys. It's great that you've been able to do that. And obviously, you know, winning is a part of the development process as well, right? Like, you guys want, your guys' primary focus is on developing players for the Toronto Blue Jays down the line, but winning can play a big component in that, right?
Definitely. Yep. 100% correct. And yeah, it's, you really want to play meaningful baseball all year long, and you are going to lose guys. And you know that, and you know, when you break camp, that the group you leave with will not be the group you finish with. And that's one thing you try to get ahead of. And there's the good, the bad, the ugly. And, you know, players get promoted. Sometimes they get hurt. Sometimes, you know, they get released. Sometimes they get traded to you or from you. And it's all just about kind of making the new players comfortable, ready to do the things that, you know, the Blue Jay way, but you still got to let the player have his autonomy and be himself. And, yeah, it's been a really special couple of years, and you know, just really appreciative for the fans, for my family, the opportunity, and all the players that we're lucky enough to work with every single day.
Wanted to ask you about a few of those players who, you know, stood out over the course of the season, and particularly down the stretch here. The one who was front of mind for me, because he came to you guys late after, you know, trying to get his way back from injury. Once you guys got your hands on Adrian Pinto, he went up. He hit 300 for the time he was with you guys. You know, what did you learn about him over those 20-25 games that he was with you guys for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, the hype is real, and you know, for a guy that's, you know, smaller in size, you know, similar to Altuve we were talking about earlier, he's got some thunder in his bat. He's a really smart baseball player. He's just had problems staying healthy, so he does everything he can to prepare and get ready and recover from every game and every day we work out. And he's had some bad luck, but man, he came to us with a bang. And I'd heard a lot about him for probably 2.5 years now since we got him in a trade, and I'd never really seen him play. I'd seen him take some live BPs in spring training, but so really had no idea what we were getting other than an extremely talented young man. And he's the whole package. Great person, really smart baseball player, and extremely talented.
Well, that's it's great to hear. And yeah, haven't seen a ton of him yet, obviously. But yeah, we hear good things here in Toronto too, even when he was, you know, still at the developmental complex. Like, hey, you got to see this guy when he gets back in game. So good to see that success for him. Some success this year as well for a guy you know a little bit better, Peyton Williams. You got to look at last year too. For any Jays fans who don't know, you've surely seen clips of the 6'6", 255-pound guy hitting bombs here and there. 11 homers and almost hit 300 for you guys this year. Believe he's headed to Arizona Fall League. What is next for Peyton Williams when it comes to developing and getting him to the next level offensively?
Peyton is as ready for the next level as any hitter we had. You know, without the injury that kind of delayed the start of his season, I would go out on a limb and say he probably would have worked his way there by the end of the year this year. Just tremendous amount of power, the ability to hit for average, hit the ball all over the field. You know, he's big in the clutch situation. He hits the baseball as hard as anyone. You know, Blue Jay fans should be excited about him. And you know, and he's a weapon from the left side of the plate. And, you know, surprisingly, you know, for his size, how big he is, like, he moves well. And I think probably going back 3 times this season, he scored from first base on a double, which is, you know, some of the ballparks we play at, not very easy. And, you know, you'd expect a guy as big and strong as he is to kind of go base to base. But really, really cerebral player, and a sneaky good defender. A left-handed first baseman is never something you dislike. So you've got the advantage of being a left-handed thrower, and he's pretty good on the dirt as well. So just really looking forward to him to continue to push himself, push his body, improve it. You know, some, you know, left on left is never easy, and he's always going to get that type of matchup being who he is and, you know, the status he carries now. So just being ready to hit the best. And I believe you're right. I think he's going to the Fall League, and what a challenge if he is there to face some of the best in this game.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. And a couple guys in the org have benefited from that in the past. Another name who I think is going there is Kendry Rojas, who started a playoff game for you guys. Was unbelievable, really, since you guys got your hands on him. 2.43 ERA he finished the season with. Still just 21 years old. What do you like about what Kendry brings to the mound and brought to the mound for you guys?
Yeah, I'm lucky enough to have seen Kendry for probably 3.5-4 years now, going back to our time in the complex league together. But he's just consistent. He's learned how he works. He's learned how to recover. He's learned how to stay on the field. And I know he had a little hiccup with some shoulder soreness this year, but he came back and it was almost 7 innings every day, guaranteed. I knew we would just look forward to Fridays because it was Kendry Day. And, you know, at the Nat at noon, or sorry, 105 nooner, at the Nat wearing red, like he was great. And he showed out in big spots. And I really think the Blue Jays are lucky to have him, and he's going to do some big things for us.
Speaking of showing out in big games, Jerome Watts-Brown probably had his best outing for you guys in the playoffs, a 10-strikeout game there early in that series. I know, you know, that was a big challenge for him in his first full pro year to get bumped to you guys midway through the season, and some of the numbers reflected that. But for him to be able to put that together with such a strong performance for you guys in the playoffs, what does that tell you about where he is?
Yeah, his time with us in Vancouver, he just continued to get better. He started for us. His first start was on July 4th, and that's not easy. We're in Everett, Washington. His first start with a new team, sold-out ballpark, and Everett was a good team. And he just continued to improve. He took some lumps, and he had some hiccups to start before the playoffs. I think he gave up 3 homers, maybe 4 in a game. And especially after that, to rebound from an outing like that and to keep working on his craft and sticking to what he does well, which was throw a good heater that rises and a sharp slider with a curveball in there and a changeup to lefties. Like, he used all 4 against Spokane there in the championship game 2. And no surprise. He would always just have one inning or one string of 3 or 4 hitters where things just didn't go his way, whatever it was, walks or hits or, you know, defensive miscues and, you know, calls that didn't go his way. But it definitely all came together for him there in the championship game 2. And it was special to watch.
Well, it's great to hear. It was fun to see that growth from afar. Brent, what is the process like for you now? Like, the season's over. Obviously, you're still a part of the Blue Jays organization. Are you, like, Dunedin bound to help with the player development side? You get a little vacation for yourself. What's the next bit look like for you?
Yeah, Blue Jays are great in terms of really respecting, you know, I've been gone for 5.5 months. And before that, spring training takes up a lot of your time. So they really understand the family aspect, and it's just been great. I really plan on being dad for the next 3 months kind of thing. And if they, you know, if they call me and ask me to work at camp, I'll be there the next day kind of thing. But no, at the moment, I think it's just being dad and a husband and, being a dog dad as well. So really just enjoying some downtime and getting our house put back together and just being there for my wife and kids.
Well, the time's well deserved, man. 3 straight runs to the championship with the Vancouver Canadiens of the Northwest League. Brent LaValle, thanks so much for taking the time out. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Anytime.
Brent LaValle, manager of the Vancouver Canadiens. Again, 3 straight trips to the finals and 1 championship in that 3-year window for the High A affiliate of the Toronto Blue Jays. Man, Kendry Rojas is a lot of fun to hear about and a lot of fun to think on. One of the certainly fastest rising, I guess, once he got back on the mound and got healthy, but one of the most interesting pitching prospects in the system. And not just because he's one of the only ones who is healthy. 12 guys, I believe, undergoing UCL procedures in the Jays minor league system this year. Yikes. Or I guess not just minor league system, because I'm including Alek Manoah in that. But yeah, not great. What is great, Bowden Francis on the hill. He'll do it again tonight. The Jays back in action at 8:05 against the Rangers. Bowden Francis against Cody Bradford. You know the deal with Bowden Francis at this point. With Cody Bradford, it's not high velo. He's going to throw like 89, 90, maybe 91. Really good location, though. Barely walks anyone. You saw yesterday, this is a Rangers team that can put up some offense. So that's relevant as well. Wanted to drop in a little note. I had intended to do this as trivia with Keegan or Chris Black, but the conversations went too long and too good. So Juan Soto hit his 40th home run last night. That makes him and Aaron Judge the only pair of teammates so far this season to both have 40 home runs. Of the last 5 pairs of teammates to do that, 2 of them were Blue Jays teammates. So there is Juan Soto and Aaron Judge this year. last year, Ronald Acuna, Matt Olson, and Marcell Ozuna, they did it three times with 40-plus there for the Braves. Then 2021, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Marcus Semien both hit 40. And then in 2015, there were three pairs of teammates, Nolan Arenado and Cargo, Albert Pujols and Mike Trout, and Jose Bautista and Josh Donaldson. So, yeah, it doesn't feel crazy that Soto and Judge both put up 40 home runs in the same season, but it's only happened six times in the last decade, twice by Blue Jays teammates. It would be really nice to see a 40 home run season for the Blue Jays. Again, Aroldis Martinez homered at AAA, by the way, probably the biggest power bat in the system. Bo Bichette back in action again tonight, Bowden Francis against Cody Bradford. It's an 8:05 game. We will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break it all down for you. Thank you to Keegan Matheson, to John Morosi, to Chris Black, and to Brent LaValle for joining us on today's show. Thanks, as always, to Amit, Austin, and Jennifer behind the glass. Hope you all have a wonderful Wednesday.